It's the Burt Cohen Show. Much of the dream is our military. It's Veterans Day 2014 when we are recording this show. And it does seem that, boy, the U.S. has sure been involved in a lot of wars of late. And of course, we honor the veterans of those wars who sacrifice themselves for the good of the country, at least in theory. And the question is, how do we best honor the veterans? These days, there's been a tremendous amount of attention on militarism. You go to and watch any football game, there's just these big military fanfare. And I believe that's largely to make up for what happened in Vietnam, when too many people, not as many as the media would say, but still too many people looked at the soldiers and said nasty things to them and kind of sometimes blamed the war on the warriors. There's a big difference between those who send them to war and those who go to war, for sure. Well, I'm very pleased to have with us today Will Hopkins, a lifelong New Hampshire resident who served for 6 years in the New Hampshire National Guard. He was decorated for valor during a year-long tour in Iraq as an infantryman, including, now get this, the fall of 2004 Fallujah Offensive. Now, we've all heard about that one. That, I understand, was a tad messy. Hopkins also served in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. He was honorably discharged upon completion of his six-year term in the National Guard. And he has a bachelor's degree in anthropology and sociology and a master's degree in business administration with a certificate of advanced graduate studies in strategic marketing management from Plymouth State University. He served as national member of the board of directors of Veterans for Peace, as well as the board of New Hampshire Peace Action Education Fund before taking over as executive director of the New Hampshire Peace Action in September of 2009. And, well, thanks very much for being with us, Will.
Oh, thank you for having me, Bert.
Well, sure. And again, thank you for your service that boy, you know what it's like, that Fallujah thing. Tell us a little bit about what that was like for you.
Sure. So I tend to like to start at the beginning, how I ended up there. And
well,
what
I was
going to
ask, what made you go? What made you go into the service, and what kept you there?
So I went straight to college after high school, and I went up to UMaine Farmington, decided to take second semester off my sophomore year to teach skiing at Tenney Mountain in Plymouth. And
sounds like fun.
Yeah, there was another instructor who had done 6 years with New Hampshire's Mountain Company. It's a mountain infantry company, and he would tell stories about going to drill and hiking, ice climbing, rock climbing, skiing, snowshoeing, rappelling, which is all stuff that Mountain Company did and still does. And you know, at that point, World Trade Tower was still standing tall. National Guard was not something that meant I was going to go overseas at that moment in history.
Yeah, sure.
So when the snow melted and I couldn't teach skiing anymore, I had some time on my hands and figured I could go through basic training and then have some help getting through school. So I joined up and went through basic training in infantry school at Fort Benning, Georgia. I graduated from Fort Benning in 2001. It was late August 2001 to be exact, so about 2 weeks before 9/11 is when I graduated.
Timing is everything. Yes.
Yeah. So I kind of followed the I was raised Unitarian Universalist, definitely you know, not somebody who was going to buy into a war lightly. And so I followed the lead up to the war in Iraq, and I did not see it as legal, moral, the right call for our country strategically. But when I got my deployment orders, I if you're enlisted and you don't report to deploy, you go to jail. So
that's a disincentive.
Yeah, and so I kind of struggled with refusing, but in the end, living with the labels coward, convict, traitor was more was scarier to me than going and fighting in a war I didn't believe in. And so I found myself in Iraq. I did serve in Fallujah during that major offensive. And what I did, I mean, I had firefights in other parts of Iraq. What I did in Fallujah, I mean, I watched the bombardment of the city, which was pretty depressing because I knew that there were families and lots of civilians in the city. But my actual job in Fallujah was to maintain the cordon, which means I shut down Main Street of a town on the outskirts of Fallujah and made sure nobody could get out or in to the city. Which is not a pleasant job when you have injured people trying to get out, people trying to go in to see their families who are trapped in. You know, but I was also low enlisted, so all I had to do was, you know, grunt and point my weapon. but it was pretty unpleasant knowing what was going on and knowing that there were civilians trying to get out of the city, and my job was to not let them.
Mm. Well, we were talking out front just before the show started about, you know, one of the big things you hear about veterans of all wars, particularly Vietnam and Afghanistan and Iraq, is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, I wonder how pervasive it is among veterans of Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan. And a question for, you know, if you go into a war, which is kind of an insane situation where your buddies get killed, you see people getting killed, you see people getting maimed, tremendous amount of pain. If you go insane, how can you not come out a little bit insane? I mean, it's just such a horrible, horrible thing. What is the government doing about that? I mean, one of the great quotes about war, I must give credit where it's due, Bernie Sanders, who I hope runs as a Democrat, says, if you can't afford to take care of your veterans, then don't go to war. Now, what about PTSD? How pervasive is it, and how much of a problem is it? How hard is it for people to get over that stuff, and is the government doing what it can for it?
Wow.
A lot of questions.
Yeah. So I had a friend, really, really dear guy, and he committed suicide last month.
Oh, my God.
And when he spoke about PTSD, he spoke about it as a spiritual wound. One of the things he did is he went to the NATO summit and threw his medals back and said that was the most healing thing that he'd experienced in his recovery. He did three tours in Afghanistan. He mentioned that to his VA counselor. He said, look, you know, what I need isn't this repeated immersion in the experience, talking about it over and over again. You know, that's not helping me. But what has helped me is being able to deny militarism, to do something to try to end war, working with Iraq veterans against the war. This has been healing for me, but you know, these sessions that we're having where I'm coming in and rehashing it, they're not doing anything. Mm-hmm. So what I need the VA to provide is a place for me to do that. And his therapist said, well, that's not, you know, that's way too political for the VA to be involved in it, and there's no way we could ever do that. And he said, so you're telling me that what I need to heal is something that is too political for you to give it to me, that you simply can't provide that to me. And he eventually did lose his battle with PTSD, and it was really hard. He was a really beloved member of the anti-war veteran community nationally, and we will miss him a lot.
Oh my, yeah, interesting how it's a question of facing reality. And you talked a bit about, well, before I get to that, I want to get to a little bit of the history for those people who listen. I love history. What can I say? Armistice Day is how it started out. It wasn't always Veterans Day. It started out the 11th of November, 1918, at the 11th hour in the 11th month. It marked the armistice, which wasn't actually a peace, actually, between the warring parties of the First World War, then called the Great War. It was between the Allies of the First World War and Germany in France. The hostilities ended on the Western Front, and it took effect on the at 11 o'clock in the morning, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918. Most countries did change the name of the holiday after World War II to honor veterans of that and subsequent conflicts. Veterans Day, of course, now honors all American veterans, whether living, dead in action, or deceased from other causes. And thinking of the First World War, I've read a fair amount about it. There's a book fairly recently by wonderful writer Adam Hochschild, who wrote To End All Wars. And he was talking about something that you, Will Hopkins, were talking about, how in the First World War, during the war, those who resisted the war were enemies. Sometimes during the war, they were lined up and shot. A lot of them were thrown in jail. There was a lot of resistance to the war by brave women in England. And at the time, they were seen as, giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Nowadays, they're seen as heroes. They are seen as heroes. And that, I suppose, is, comes back a little bit to the political aspect of it here, that, at the time, there's one thing, the people who resist, who speak out. It makes me think back to, during the war in Vietnam, those soldiers who came back and threw their medals at the Capitol building. I wonder how that was perceived at the time among people who were still in the military and those who did it, and how it might be perceived nowadays.
And I think there are always people who are going to perceive things like that both ways. I certainly remember being in the military and knowing that Lieutenant Aaron Watada and Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia had refused to serve in Iraq. That was as I was deploying.
Right.
These were men who, certainly in the military, they were demonized. The folks in the military didn't like them. At the same time, silently, I was admiring their courage. And then a few weeks ago, we had Camilo Mejia come speak in Concord at the Bektash Hall for our fall, New Hampshire Peace Action's fall fundraiser. Today I look at them as my personal heroes, the people who had the courage to do what I think I should have done.
How often do veterans beat up on themselves? My goodness,
oh,
here for you're saying what I should have done.
Yeah. Some of us do, some of us don't. I think, I look at what I did as something that was bigger than one person, because I had three firefights in a week at one point. I was engaged, decorated for valor, there's kind of a veiled meaning there of some of the things that I did. How can you, if you think there's a God, how can you know that someday you're going to have to look at that God and say, yeah, I did that. I took another sacred life. This idea that when you do something that huge, it's, and you're part of something as huge as the destruction of Iraq. How do you make up for that in your lifetime? How do you, I've got a story about how I feel that I've healed in many ways. But,
sure, yeah, let's get to that.
Okay. And it's a big question. And I know I still, 10 years later, I'm still beating up on myself over the things I was a part of and the things I did. But at the same time, I have some grace. I've been able to make peace work my profession. I remember about a year after I started at New Hampshire Peace Action, I had a meeting with Congressman Charlie Bass, and I read reports from meetings of other directors of New Hampshire Peace Action with Charlie Bass and his various offices, and they all kind of said, this man has no respect for us. He disregards us as hippies, and you're not going to really make any traction with this guy. And I I went in, and Charlie Bass first had to thank me for my service. I explained what my resume, which Charlie didn't have combat experience, but understood what that meant. And then I this was at the time of the second surge in Afghanistan. And I explained what counterinsurgency said about how many troops you needed for counterinsurgency theory to be effective, which I don't believe it ever is, but I didn't tell Charlie Bass that. And I talked to him about what counterinsurgency theory said for numbers, which according to counterinsurgency theory, you need over 600,000 troops to control Afghanistan. And we crested 100,000 at the height, but we never got anywhere near those numbers. And until then, counterinsurgency theory holds that the more troops you put in, the worse the situation's going to get until you hit this saturation point. And that's what the numbers show, too. The more troops you put in, the more instances of violence, the more casualties you have, the more civilian casualties, the more expensive. And that there's supposed to be this saturation point at which when you dump more troops in, things start to get better. And you hold that for 10 years, and that's the philosophy behind it. And so, you know, I said, this is Barack Obama's policy. Right. You're a Republican. You're not going to oppose the president when you know that scientifically, according to counterinsurgency theory, which, again, I think is complete bunk. I don't think that you can stand on a people long enough that they'll lose all will to fight.
Yeah.
Which is what really that's holding. And you know, I walked out of the meeting feeling a little bit like he really hadn't heard me. But the next week he published an op-ed. My turn in the Concord Monitor, and it said, I've been around the state talking to veterans, and I've decided I can't support this surge of troops into Afghanistan. Oh. And he voted the right way on the two pieces of legislation I talked to him about. And so for me, and I've had, this has been a recurring theme, that folks listen to what I say a little more because I've been there.
Sure,
and,
absolutely.
In peace work, that's meant that I've been able to make some meaning out of what I did. And for me, that is what I attribute my apparent sanity to. And I certainly, I'm not the same person, never will be the same person I was before I left. But I can function and I can carry myself and get away with pretending to be normal because I've been able to make sense of it in this way and find a purpose for what I did and find a path.
Boy, there's sometimes life hands you these. I think most of the time, life hands you things that you don't expect, and how you handle them just makes all the difference in the world. And I think about it, just it tears me apart to think about veterans like you beating themselves up when you didn't make the policy. You did not make the policy. And I remember, you know, all the PTSD after Vietnam and all the, you know, veterans who were tearing themselves up. And I thought, you know, doing something about it, making some change. And frankly, I was upset when Lyndon Johnson died before he could be put on trial. And Nixon and Kissinger is still alive. Free. He is still free. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it help? I just wonder from a veteran who, like many veterans, had some spiritual wound. If these guys, instead of directing your anger inward, because it wasn't your fault, if it could be directed where it belongs, you know, wouldn't that help restore some of the sanity to a lot of the veterans who are wounded? Yeah.
I know it has for me, and I've seen it help a lot of other folks. You know, I've seen people who are able to make some sense of their experience through doing some work to change things. And certainly a disproportionate amount of the peace movement, when I have a rally or a conference, a disproportionate number of the people who are there are veterans or family members of veterans who have seen firsthand what war is and how it affects people.
So, I do think that, you know, an action like throwing the medals, that was very brave. It took a tremendous amount of courage, and it's got to help psychically, I would think. And I do hope that Henry Kissinger someday is arrested and put on trial for his... In Vietnam, if you haven't seen the movie, you may have, The Trials of Henry Kissinger. I don't want to go too far into this off court, but there was a peace deal in 1968. All sides had basically agreed with it. It wasn't made public yet, But Kissinger personally went to President Thieu of Vietnam and said, walk away from this peace deal with the North because you get a better deal after Nixon's elected. And how many thousands of people died, Americans and Vietnamese, how many thousands of limbs were lost because of Henry Kissinger doing that? It's just horrible. If you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is Will Hopkins, who is executive director of New Hampshire Peace Action. And we're talking about Veterans Day, how best to honor our veterans. And people don't want to talk much about Vietnam these days. It's like it just kind of disappeared. It's swept under the rug. Now, I hope to have on this show at some future point a discussion about there is a movement to tell the truth about Vietnam, to look really into it. I mean, Reagan became president in 1980 and had his glorious military victory in the great threatening island of Grenada, which helped us get over the Vietnam syndrome so that we could be the masters of war once again. And so how important, I mean, we haven't seen... I read another wonderful book called The Culture of Defeat, How Nations That Do Get Defeated in Wars Can Learn a Tremendous Amount, whereas those who win, you know, tend to not learn as much. A very interesting book. What are your thoughts about facing the truth about Vietnam? How important is it for, not just for the country, but for veterans in specific? And maybe the reason we don't want to face it is so that we can have more military adventures, because... let's face it, we did not win in Vietnam. And, you know, if people were to think, oh, my goodness, our policy was wrong there, ooh, maybe they might question future policies. I don't know.
I mean, I think it needs to be part of a history of war not working. You know, we have World War II is held up as this time when the U.S. came in at the last minute and saved the world from the Nazi threat. And that is the dominant narrative of war. But in reality, we've had several wars, depending on how you count wars.
Right.
You know, no declared wars, right. But we've had, you know, Vietnam, Korea. I mean, if you look at the places we've bombed, you're talking about at least one country every year that's being victim to acts of war by the United States. It needs to be part. Vietnam needs to be part of a history that includes Operation Hurricane in Afghanistan that led to the Taliban and Al Qaeda. It needs to be part of the history of the Shah in Iran, of how acting in a military manner, whether bombing or covert intervention, or troops on the ground, how that frequently leads to unintended consequences. And I think Iraq needs to be part of that too. I mean, most expensive war in the world. And now we have ISIS, because we did not have any strategy for, once we deposed Saddam Hussein, how we were going to help Iraq become a stable nation again. And that it needs to be part of an ongoing narrative of the folly of war.
And it does seem that, you know, instead of actual history, it's so much more convenient to just look at this nice, neat narrative all wrapped up in a box with a bow. You know, but Cambodia, for example, we toppled the government there. There was a government that we had set up, and Lon Nol was our guy there, and then Pol Pot came in as a direct result of again, Kissinger's terror bombing of the entire country there. And they were not nice guys either, the Khmer Rouge. They were incredibly brutal, and we, you know, kind of walked away from that, and these unintended consequences. And you think about people... you know, if you have the military theory, the numbers theory, that if you have enough, then you can hold them down. It didn't work when Hitler was bombing London. You know, they didn't exactly give up. They were under tremendous pressure. And what could be worse than that? It doesn't seem to work. No.
No, I don't think there's a single example in history where counterinsurgency theory has played out as it's as it's written. You know, this idea that when you can saturate it at one combat troop per 20 civilians, and if you can hold that for 9 or 10 years, things just calm down and magically stabilize. There's no time when an occupation has functioned that way. When there's always if things settle after an occupation, it's always because there is, there's independence granted and a withdrawal date given, or because there's some sort of agreement met, or there's some sort of, we're going to give you access to water and medical care and food, and eventually transition to your control. And that saying we're going to leave, well, that's, you know, that is a victory for the insurgent forces, and that can be effective. Saying we are leaving, we're not going to keep doing this. But otherwise, when you occupy people, they're going to fight back.
And you used that word "occupy" in the most recent election. I forget who, but somebody caught a lot of flack for saying. I think it was our senator from New Hampshire, Gene Shaheen, who said basically the same thing. If you have an occupying force, it ain't going to win. And people said, how dare you say occupier? We're not occupiers. Occupiers are bad guys. What's your reaction to that?
Of course we're occupiers. I mean, what else is what we did in Iraq, what we're doing in Afghanistan still? I mean, you put military force in someone else's country and run a police state, that's occupation. To not, we love our euphemisms. We say depleted uranium instead of irradiating rounds, which in Fallujah at this point, 20% of the babies who are born are classified and deformed. 75% of those are dead within the first 2 years because we dumped tons of depleted uranium rounds in, what we call depleted uranium, which I think we should call irradiated rounds. I mean, it's a half-life of 4.2 billion years. So in the city of Fallujah, it will never again, for the rest of humanity, be safe to have to bear children.
So we, the United States, put depleted uranium, what did you call it?
We call it armor-piercing dual-purpose. And what it is uranium that it's spent uranium.
Right.
Uranium. It's still radioactive.
Right. And that goes into bullets and ordnance.
Yeah. 50 caliber rounds are the smallest, but then it moves up from there. It's the coating of our 155 artillery rounds. Big missiles frequently are tipped with depleted uranium. Fallujah, until Fukushima, had become the most irradiated city on Earth for a time. So,
and nobody's heard about that.
It's pretty quiet.
Wow! No, yeah. Oh my goodness! Well, if you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is Will Hopkins, who was decorated for valor for his work as an infantryman in 2004 in Fallujah in Iraq, and is now executive director of New Hampshire Peace Act. Too often we do have people making wars who haven't been in wars. I think one of the greatest presidents of the 20th century was Dwight Eisenhower. He had seen war. He knew what it was. And I don't think he started any wars. Not did he? Not that I can think of. Yeah. I mean, there was some support for the French in Vietnam, but not quite the same. Well, of course, we mentioned ISIS or ISIL. And, it's a very difficult problem right now. We can't sit back and do nothing. These guys are, they're not nice people, to put it mildly. But the Veterans for Peace has something called 6 Ways Short of War. Because it does seem to me, as I've noticed since ISIL or ISIS has existed, that it seems odd how everything we do, the more we bomb them, the more territory they seem to get. And it seems also to me, from your knowledge, it appears that who was best organized after, the fall of Saddam Hussein and after the government that we installed there, the occupation government, the only group really standing up, unfortunately, terribly, horribly, was ISIS or ISIL. So, I mean, we've seen their beheadings and murdering people. They torture kids, Kurdistani kids. Tell us about the six ways short of war that we can do to take on these guys, because we can't just let them.
All right. So I want to address the two. First, when I started researching ISIS, I had to pause because I thought, all right, I'm New Hampshire peace action. It's my job to advocate against war. Am I advocating against war just because that's my job? Or can I take a principled stance against this? Because it looked like at that point, and I think indeed maybe we did, in the short term, bombing ISIS had the potential to save innocent lives.
Yes.
And that's really hard to argue.
And those people who are on a mountaintop, it saved their
Yazidi,
lives.
The Yazidi, absolutely. Yes, well, you could argue the PKK was more involved in saving their lives. The Kurdistani force that came in and pulled them out. But certainly our bombing assisted that. That couldn't have happened without our bombing. So it's it was a really tough moment for me. And this weekend, I went to hear from Phyllis, who wrote the six steps short of war to beat ISIS, and Noam Chomsky in Boston.
Wonderful.
And
is it Phyllis Bennis?
Phyllis Bennis, yes. And I think Phyllis Bennis is probably, in my opinion, she's the greatest foreign policy mind that the U.S. has right now. She's somebody who gets things in a way that I don't think anybody else does, and has a vision that includes what the blowback's going to be from our military policy. She's an internationalist. She's somebody who gets the importance of working with other nations, who recognizes what America's role can and should be.
So Phyllis Bennis.
That's who
we want for the next Secretary of State.
I would love that. she's brilliant. She's truly brilliant. And she wrote this article. But one of the things that Phyllis, that Bennis and Chomsky both agreed on is that ISIS is growing in power because it's an easy sell to angry young Muslim men in the Middle East to come fight the empire. Come fight the United States. They're invading country after country. They're bombing country after country. Come be part of fighting that. It's an easy sell. And the more we bomb them, the more that sell becomes true. The more we do things to try to violently oppose them, the more true it becomes that we're intervening, and the sexier that cause becomes. And this is an outfit that has Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I mean, they are social media and marketing savvy in the modern age. And so they're somebody who our reaction to them has been exactly what they wanted it to be, and it has been a huge recruiting tool. And so we need to realize that and look at things we can do that are outside of that. And so Phyllis put together these six steps short of war to beat ISIS. Number one, stop the airstrikes. And that, given what I just said, it seems obvious. I don't know that I'll ever be able to, with a straight face, say we shouldn't have assisted the PKK by bombing and stopping them, and so that they could rescue the Yazidi. That I don't know that I can even as the peace guy that I can get behind that. I think what we did there may have been the right call. It was a recruiting tool, so it's making things worse. But we saved a lot of innocent lives. So that I wouldn't make that argument right now. I there may be peace activists out there who are furious with me, but I can't say for sure. I'm not there. And it seemed like it may have saved innocent lives. So.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, maybe in a big sense, perhaps politically, it's the wrong thing to do. But if it saved a lot of lives, it's tough to argue with.
It's tough to argue with, yeah. Step two, make real a commitment for no boots on the ground. We just doubled our presence in northern Iraq last week.
Right after the election.
Right after
curious?
The election. It's like, here, we're going to put more troops in. So we need to make that real. That means that the reality that ISIS is resistance to U.S. and the idea that U.S. is empire that is going to continue to bomb and invade and occupy in the Middle East indefinitely is what makes it sexy. So, pull out the advisors we've got and don't put more boots on the ground. That's what ISIS is feeding off of, that and the bombings. So organize a real diplomatic partnership to deal with ISIS. And Obama took a lot of flack for writing this letter to the Ayatollah. And the reality is that the CIA holds in every strategic analysis of Iran that Iran has not been pursuing nuclear weapons since 2003.
Right.
That they want a medical reactor and that they're not going to stop until they get a medical reactor. But they had plates for their medical reactor for years, and they've expired. What they need, the linchpin of reaching an agreement with Iran that includes them not enriching past 20%, are these plates. The resistance in the Senate to reaching any sort of agreement with Iran is ridiculous. We are not going to, through military action with Iran would be disastrous. We're talking 2.5 times the population and over twice the surface area of Iraq. It is not like Afghanistan with sheep herders. It's a fully developed country with a major economy.
Yes.
And if we're talking about trying to militarily stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons, we've got a huge. It's not a feasible military operation. So we're going to need to talk to Iran. We're going to need to reach a diplomatic solution that includes plates for their medical reactor.
And it is in our interest for them not to have nuclear bombs.
Sure.
So strategically, what's going to work? Is it going to work to try to militarily, take care?
Right. No. Right. And their current president was elected on a platform of doing diplomacy with the U.S. That was his entire
really?
Platform.
Funny how we haven't heard much about that.
We have so much resistance in the Senate. We can't talk to Iran.
Right.
Well, we have to talk to Iran. It's the reality of our situation. Especially if we want to control ISIS. The PKK is the only organization that at present has put up any sort of credible military resistance to ISIS, and we still count them as a terrorist group because they fought with Turkey. So this is something that we maybe need to rethink how we're dealing with the PKK. So that it also means that I don't know that we want to go as far as to engage diplomatically with Assad, but the idea that there's such a thing as a moderate rebel that we can fund in Syria is absurd.
If
you have taken up arms, you are not a moderate. There is no such thing. It's an oxymoron. It's military intelligence.
It's FUBAR.
It's FUBAR. There's no such thing. And Andy Borowitz made a great questionnaire for the moderate Syrian rebel that I hope everyone looks at.
I have to look at that.
So the rest of these steps, step four, initiate, I'm sorry, step five, push the UN to restart real negotiations on ending the civil war in Syria. We need to be able to, not as the U.S., who hates Assad, but as a world concerned about human rights in Syria, engage with the Assad regime. And maybe that means that we can push him to step down. Maybe it means that concessions are made. But one way or another, we need global engagement in that discussion. And step six, massively increase U.S. humanitarian contributions. And when your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And we spend right now, depending on how you break down the military budget, as much as 60% of the discretionary budget goes into Pentagon funding. If you look at the full budget and you include CIA, NSA, FBI, the militarization of police, you can get up to 53%. There are people who've done analyses that is essentially security, what we call security. And I think security is kind of a silly thing. It's not how our government is no longer really concerned that the Canadians or the Mexicans are going to come across the border and take over the U.S. We're a pretty darn secure nation.
Well, a lot of that fear was fanned in the recent despicable election, the one that Scott Brown tried to do by conjuring up obvious and clear racism about, immigrants. He tried to make it immigrants equals ISIS equals Ebola. Be very, very afraid.
Yeah.
And what does that get us? And it's funny how Ebola just disappeared after the election. We're talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Will Hopkins, a veteran of the New Hampshire National Guard, who have served in Iraq at Fallujah and is now executive director of New Hampshire Peace Action. And these days, as I mentioned, I think a little bit before about football games, pretty much anything, there's always these flyovers. We seem to have reverence for all things military. My guess is to, frankly, make up for not always the best treatment of veterans who came home from Vietnam. You know, I think a lot of it was a terrible mistake. It wasn't as bad as the media made it out to be, but people sometimes confuse the warrior with the war in Vietnam. And it was really, they were victims as well. My goodness, perhaps some of the most victims. But I wonder how this plays out with veterans now. Like, every person in a uniform means a hero. They're a hero now. And I wonder how much that kind of feeds into the militaristic momentum that we have been on lately to create more wounded soldiers, more wounded warriors, and this whole treating everybody in a uniform as a hero. And I would think guys and women who have been in the military know that, well, golly gee, not everybody is really a hero. What's your take on how that plays out for veterans now and for the future?
Yeah, this is a really great question, because there's this, you know, the idea that Bernie Sanders so eloquently put across, that if we're going to send people to war, we need to take care of them afterwards, and that, you know, indeed, I didn't want to fight in Iraq. If I had a choice about it, I would not have gone to Iraq.
I'm sure.
But at the same time, the idea that every plane ride you're on, that veterans get to, you know, that active military get to deplane, board first and deplane first, and that there's they're honored at football games, it does have it's teaching, especially children, that the wars are okay, and that, you know, this idea that if you put on the uniform, you're a hero and you just do what you're told and you go, and I think that's really harmful, and I think it enables the culture of war that we have. It's a constant challenge for me as a veteran and as a peace activist. You know, how much time do I spend with that hero worship? Or how much credence do I get it when I also realize the damage that it's doing? And that's not to say that we shouldn't be taking care of medical care, but I think we should be taking care of medical care for everyone, or psychological care. But I think we should be taking care of psychological care for everyone.
Yes.
And we need to recognize that what veterans did, that at least they believed it was right and just and true and for Absolutely. And for the right causes. And
Absolutely.
We need to make sure that we're valuing the sacrifices made. But at the same time, in American politics, 94% of the time, it's the person who spends the most money who gets elected. And the other 6% of the time, it's the person who spends the second most amount of money. 7 out of 10, when you aggregate funders, 7 out of 10 of the top funders of Barack Obama were the same funders as John McCain in their first election. There are lots of interests that are funding both parties, and a lot of those interests are Pentagon contractors. And a lot of them are basing their profits on things like oil resources, or in the case of Afghanistan, iron, copper, bauxite, gold, lithium,
really?
You know, these minerals that are being harvested in northern Afghanistan. And when there is a profit motive, that seems to be more of what's fueling our foreign policy. And we need people to know that part of what you do when you fight for the U.S. military is the bidding of people who... when you are the CEO of a business, your job is to maximize profit to the shareholders. And I think to some extent, when you are a congressperson or a senator, your job is to maximize profits to the people who gave you the money to get elected. And that's what develops our policy. And that's how we interact with the world as a country.
So how can, you know, it's exceedingly difficult to even address this whole big reverence for all things military these days, because you can make people angry about that. You know, how dare you not honor these veterans? You know, I wonder how that is dealt with. And I mean, you and I know that to worship all things military is not the same as, you know, honoring the veteran.
Yeah, it's delicate. I mean, people do get upset, you know, just to hear what I said, that there's a damage to this hero worship, this culture of, and I'm not, and at the same time, you know, I want to be very grateful to the Vietnam vets who went through what they did. So, you know, because when I got here, I was hailed as a hero. People did celebrate me. Right. And in the peace movement, people celebrated me, and folks on the right who knew that I'd served celebrated me for that. And I'm not, you know, and I'm grateful for that. But at the same time, it scares me when my 6-year-old stepdaughter comes home from school and talks about saying the pledge and sings this patriotic song that they've got her singing and says, "Well, we get Tuesday off because we're honoring the men who died for our freedom." And I want to say, wait a minute, you know, like how did what I did in Iraq protect her freedom? It had nothing to do with anyone's freedom. And so it's challenging because I want to, you know, and I want to call up the school and say, can't teach her that. That's not true. And she's 6. She doesn't know better.
Right.
And I know that, but the last thing she needs is that extra challenge in school where she's questioning it. So I usually bite my tongue. But it's a cultural problem for us, and it leads to more war and more militarism. And it's something we should be addressing.
Yeah, and that's one thing, that the narrative, there's, you know, what people take as history is oftentimes myth. You know, it's official myth, and it can lead to a lot of problems that could be avoided if we actually dealt with it. That's a very interesting, very real situation. You know, they fought for our freedom. I mean, I'm sure that's the intention of the guys and women that go there.
It was my intention when I joined up. Well, I suppose joining the National Guard in early 2001, my intention was more to fill sandbags and be there if there was an ice storm and
Katrina,
get college
did,
for free. But I did do that in Katrina. But, you know, it wasn't, you know, but the idea certainly of most, you know, soldiers are not, not by and large bad people. They are people who want to protect their country and defend freedom and liberty and democracy.
And we do have to respect that and honor that. Yeah. And mistakes were made with Vietnam, you know, let's not, we need to look at what it really is. What about relations between, say, the veterans of foreign wars and, you know, mainstream in quotes, veterans groups and Veterans for Peace? Tell us about the relations there. It's
very, very variable. You know, here in New Hampshire, there's definitely a sharp division. Vets for Peace marches in every Memorial Day and Veterans Day parade in Manchester. And we're generally held in a position of considerable hostility. We march behind behind the Girl Scouts, behind the junior high school bands, and we've frequently been given the wrong time that the parade starts, so that we usually figure it out on our own.
Oh my goodness!
You know, it's not pleasant. There are also chapters of I know there are VFW halls where Vets for Peace members make up every officer in the VFW hall.
Huh.
And so it varies around the country. I do know that that there's a frequent pledge given, or not a pledge, but a toast given when drinking or eating in a VFW hall that says to me being the last veteran. You know, this idea that nobody else should have to go through it is not something they're hostile to. You know, some of the broader leftist politics that Vets for Peace takes on, not very popular largely right-wing military base. But,
and, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the Veterans Administration really screwed up. I don't know whose fault it was particularly. They've got to be doing better. And now there's all these ads on TV about the wounded warriors. I mean, the reality is that people are coming back from these wars alive, whereas in very recent times they would have been killed, and there's serious damage and a lot of expenses. It's really tough on the families. Do you have any sense that the government is getting the message and starting to treat veterans better? It seems to me, maybe I'm wrong, but for the longest time, it does seem that not enough care of veterans was happening, that somehow they didn't really focus on that. They focused on, you know, weapon systems and sending people off to war, but not always with the proper equipment and supplies and things like that, sending them into battle. Is there progress being made on that, do you think?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, Shinseki's resignation was a witch hunt. There was no part of his management that was responsible for it.
And what was his title again? He was
the
head of the Veterans
Administration. Yeah, the head of the Veterans Administration. I don't know if it was director or if he was secretary of Veterans Affairs or what the title was, but he was the head. And before that, he was Army Chief of Staff. And
so he was sacrificed.
Which, you know, like, oh, we've taken out Shinseki, everything should be fixed. Shinseki was nothing if not a highly competent manager. He did his job the best he could. You know, certainly funding for VA for the Veterans Administration is a problem. I don't know where in the VA there are management issues and where there are funding issues. I'm sure there are both. And the reality is I about a year after I got back from Iraq, I overshot the landing on a ski jump and tore both meniscuses in my ACL and my right knee. And it took 11 months for me to get in to see an orthopedic surgeon and finally get surgery.
Oh, my God.
yeah.
11 months?
11 months. It was... I worked construction on it. I didn't crutch. It was excruciating, but I somehow managed it. I still don't have an ACL in my right knee. I ended up with blood clots. Long story. Mm. But
I see you're very skilled at beating up on yourself.
the VA hospitals. You know, if you go to White River. You have a pretty good experience. If you go to Manchester, probably not so much. And I know that Manchester is not the worst. I know where I live in Belmont, where I used to live in Plymouth, it was well over an hour if I wanted to get to a VA hospital. And that was, where I got healthcare. So
hopefully, it doesn't matter, Democrat, Republican, that, and I generally find when people make noise, they make enough noise, things finally get addressed.
Yeah.
And it seems like people are saying, hey, you can't treat veterans like this. You just can't do it. So
It may be changing. I'm not sure. I know I got a card in the mail. I'm not sure what it means that said that I can now go see private practitioners with my VA coverage. Which I'm interested to see if that pans out in any way. It also said it was a temporary program. And I'm curious to see if things do improve at VA hospitals. I think we had the Walter Reed scandal, which was kind of the early warning sign. But I don't expect usually when I need medical care, I don't expect. Unless I'm going to an emergency room, that I'm going to be able to see anyone for a few weeks usually. And if I need a specialist, it's going to be a few months. And I've gotten used to that.
And I'm thinking back, I believe it was Rumsfeld, I think it was, who said you got to fight a war with the weapons that you have. And we were sending people into Iraq with their vehicles, didn't have the armor on the bottom. Yeah. And the people there actually fashion their own protective equipment.
Yeah.
That just amazes me. I just, and I would think, I sense that the mood of the country is changing, that you don't send people into war without the proper equipment. You don't, you know, if they're going to have chemical exposure, if they're going to have, you got to take care of their health care. I do hope that is changing. I'm just going to ask as perhaps the last question here, the word patriotism. What does it mean to you?
Oh, geez. I don't have a simple answer.
I'm sure it's not a simple question.
It definitely has a confused emotional response in me, because nationalism is definitely a part of it. And I think nationalism is something that humanity should disregard. In the case of US or the case of any other nation, a child is a child is a child, and no child is any less human, any less sacred, any less innocent than any other. And anywhere you go, there are good people, there are bad people.
Right.
And we should abandon this idea that be patriotic to the nation you live in. For me, I do want to see the United States do well. I want to be able to be proud of my country. And for me, that means disregarding, to cast off militarism, wars, unnecessary wars and interventions. It means taking care of the most vulnerable among us. I want to be proud of this country. And maybe that's what was instilled in me when I was 6 years old and in first grade. But one way or another, it's still there in me. A real love for this country. But I have some shame over the way our government has managed it.
Telling the truth isn't always easy, but it's got to be done. I feel the same. I mean, I was brought up in the 50s, a little before you, and patriotism, I mean, it's just who we are. And I still feel that. And I believe in the ideals of this country, you know, not being imperialistic, you know, not being militaristic. This is not.
There's nothing wrong with freedom and democracy. Those are good things.
And a Republican form of government. Absolutely. Well, if people are interested in catching up with Veterans for Peace and your organization, there must be some sort of website to which you can point them.
Sure, yeah. Veterans for Peace is veteransforpeace.org, and nhpeaceaction.org is New Hampshire Peace Action. We're not far from you, so if you hear this, we're there. We're encouraging you to get involved. We've got regular educational programming, rallies, marches, vigils, conferences. We need your help.
And I can imagine it's good for the soul, especially if you're a veteran.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. And
the
warriors themselves are very, very different, as I said, from the Masters of War.
It's called Masters of War. Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs. I just want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive, where a war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. Then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. Oh, threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins.